Benefit of those who were not able to be with us on Wednesday night, as we look at this particular question, this passage, and then all the questions that we talk about this quarter, we're not trying to cause anybody difficulty. You may have a view or a practice that's based upon your understanding of this passage. We're not trying to disabuse anybody of their thinking or make them violate their conscience. What we're trying to do is just be New Testament Christians and open-mindedly look at God's Word and just see what it says, and then try to then talk about how that would apply to us. So let's go ahead and look at this. The problem, as we have noted, is that Paul is addressing here in Corinth the problem of the proper head adornment of men and women when praying and prophesying. He's very explicit about that as the immediate issue. And I think everybody would agree that the underlying problem, the fundamental problem, is the failure to properly reflect the roles of God, Christ, man, and woman. I'll just read a few verses, won't read the entire section, but just to emphasize this point. Verse 2, "Now I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. But every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels." Let me just stop there. So, again, this is the issue that Paul is raising here, and I remind you what we emphasized Wednesday, that in this section of the Corinthian letter, he's responding to their letter, where they had raised questions and asked things of Paul. And so he's addressing that, and he commends them for their desire to follow the traditions that that God had given through Paul the apostle, and to follow those things and everything. But here is an issue he's wanting them to think about very, very seriously. The proper head adornment of men and women, and whether or not the way they adorn their head would properly reflect the roles of God, Christ, man, and woman, that hierarchy that God has set up. God being the head of Christ, Christ being the head of man, and then man being the head of woman. So this is the underlying issue that he is addressing here. Now, the major question that we've been discussing in all this is, what kind of head adornment is Paul talking about here? And is he applying a social custom, those things that would have been customary and signified certain things in that Corinthian culture, or is he enforcing a universal law for all Christians throughout time? Here's the proper way that you need to be adorning your head when you pray and prophesy. So those are the questions that we're especially wanting to look at. And just very quickly, as we talked about last time, some people suggest that the head adornment he's talking about is the hair. Paul mentions the hair in verses 14 and 15. Some suggest the issue was the actual length of hair, that the Corinthian women were cutting their hair and looking more like a man, and so Paul's addressing that. Some say that it's the style of the hair, that they were normally would have their hair up in that feminine style of that day, but they were letting it down when they would pray and prophesy, and that's the problem. So we had looked at just some signs of the hairstyle and this type of thing, and so some have suggested that it's all the issue of the hair, either the length of the hair or when they would pray and prophesy, apparently thinking, well, now I'm in the role of a man, and so I'm going to pray and prophesy with my hair down and not in this feminine style. And so Paul responds to that. That is one possibility. I don't personally think that really is what Paul's talking about here. I personally think that he is talking about an artificial covering, and this is probably the more common understanding of the passage. A veil or some kind of head attire, and that the only reason why he brings up the hair in verses 14 and 15 is to make an analogy. And so when you look at that culture, I don't think there's any question that these kinds of veils were worn. We looked at some examples of that. Either a separate item of clothing atop the head like that, or the toga pulled up over the head so the head would be covered. And certainly we know that ancient women in that Greco-Roman culture did cover their head. And the reason for doing that was as a sign of submission. And that would have been showing deference to one's husband as the head of the woman. So wearing some kind of a veil like that. Now we also noted this, and people sometimes don't realize this, but it also is a fact that Roman men would cover their heads as a sign of submission when they were engaged in religious acts to the pagan deities. When they would pray or offer sacrifices or prophesy in these pagan rituals, Roman men covering their head was something that was well known, and it distinguished Roman men from Greek men. It was a cultural thing. Roman men, when they would pray and prophesy and offer sacrifices to the pagan deities, they would put a veil on their head, like what you see here, or they would pull up their toga and cover their head. And again, this was a sign of submission to their head, the gods, in that Roman culture. Greek men didn't do that, but Roman men did. And that's the important point. Roman men covered their heads to perform worship acts. And that's what we talked about last time, and that was a noted difference from Greek men. Now, everything that we've said there, I think, are just facts. And you know, now the issue then is, okay, does all this, you know, how does it apply or maybe help us understand, if it does, what Paul is saying here in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 2 and following? So let's just go ahead and look at these verses now in depth, and we'll try to analyze all of this with this background. And I'm going to give you my take on this, and I want everyone to feel totally comfortable to raise questions, disagree with me, give your own take on this. What we're doing right now, though, and I want to emphasize this, what we're doing right now is trying to understand what Paul was saying to them. Right now is not the time to bring up, well, I know a church where there were people that did this, and that's not where we're at now. We are going to talk about the application of all this to our circumstances here in our day, but we first of all always need to understand what was the inspired writer saying to those people then. So that's our format here. Okay. Again, when you look at verses 3 and following, I think it's important to see that Paul starts out with this hierarchy. And who is the head of a woman, according to what Paul says? A man. And who? And why is that so? What's the reason that he gives for why there's that hierarchy there, that a man is the head of a woman? Okay, yeah, he doesn't simply give that as some kind of a cultural thing, does he? Like, okay, this is a culture. In some cultures, the men are the head of the woman, but in other cultures, they aren't. That's not how he presents that principle, does he? In fact, he makes it very clear. This is the way God set it up from the very beginning. And, of course, he especially emphasizes this in verses 8 and following, for man does not originate from the woman, but woman from the man. For indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. And what is he basing those statements on? Just going back to Genesis, right? I mean, he's just pointing out what the scriptures taught, what Genesis taught about the order of creation, that the man was created first. And that second point, why was the woman created? For the sake of the man. What particular passage or idea is he alluding to there in Genesis 2? Yeah, when God said, it's not good for the man to be alone, I will make him a helper suitable for him. This is what God set up from the very beginning. So this hierarchy, this idea of man being made in the image of God, and then the woman being made, as Paul then goes on to say, in the image of the man who's in the image of God, and she's made to be the helper of the man. You know, that order is something that God set up from the very beginning. So is that principle cultural and just limited to one society? No, that's universal. And I think we need to especially emphasize that point, because whether or not we determine that the head covering that he's talking about, whether that would be something that would reflect these roles according to their society, and so the head covering per se is societal, the roles that he's talking about for men and women that need to be demonstrated in one society, those roles for men and women, those are not cultural. Those are universal. And why especially do I want to emphasize that in our culture today? Because that's exactly what our culture tries to deny. That in fact, very often people will try to say that the idea of the man being the head of the woman, that's just a cultural idea. And so we don't need to think that we have to still follow that principle. Well, I mean, I think it's very clear Paul is basing that on the creation order. And I don't know of another passage that so explicitly makes that point. So I think we need to start with that principle, and that's the principle Paul is starting with. Okay? Comments or questions about that? Yeah, Agnes? Okay, well now, first of all, let me just kind of clarify a point of fact. You're referring to the statement I had made on Wednesday night about how we're probably all aware that even today, Orthodox Jewish men will wear a kippah on their head when they engage in prayer or when they enter into a synagogue. That practice, all the evidence indicates it did not go back to the first century. That was after the New Testament period. So, in fact, a couple of centuries at least after that. So, you know, I don't think you can try to put that back on the first century period. But what that does illustrate is that itself was a cultural practice that originated among Jewish men in the subsequent centuries. Okay. All right, any other comment or question before we move on and look at these verses in more detail? All right, so then Paul says in verse 4, having first asserted the principle of the hierarchy, God and Christ, head of man, man, head of woman, he then says in verse 4, every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. Now, as I said Wednesday night, probably the more common way that that verse has been understood by people is, well, Paul's just kind of raising that as sort of a hypothetical. Not that men would ever pray and prophesy with their head covered, these Christian men, but Paul just raises that to say that if you women break out of your role, well, what if a man did the same thing? But as I suggested to you, if you really put this in historical context, it seems to me that it makes a lot of sense to realize that when he talks about this in verse 4, that's not just some hypothetical he's raising. That was part of the issue at Corinth. It may be that the women, that was more of the worry, but nevertheless, at least part of the issue was that when these Christian men in Corinth, this Roman city, this Roman colony, when those Christian men in Corinth, if they would pray and prophesy with their head covered, that would probably have given everybody in Corinth, especially if this in some way was observed by non-Christians, whether you want to take this as visitors in the worship assembly, if that's where this is happening, or if it's outside of the worship assembly, where this kind of praying and prophesying is going on, kind of like what you see in Acts 2. Whatever, any non-Christians from that Roman world, if they're seeing these Christian men praying and prophesying with their head covered, what are they going to think? That they're doing it to honor, to show submission to whom? To their pagan gods. And, I don't know if if maybe this was just something that was such a common thing for Roman men, Corinthian Roman men, when they would engage in these kinds of worship acts in their pagan pre-Christian life, that now that they became Christians, they still did it and just weren't thinking. Or maybe they were thinking, well, I'm showing my submission to my new head, Jesus Christ, but, however they might have thought about that or not thought about it, it seems to me what Paul is saying is, when you do that, it's really going to be dishonoring your real head. And who is the real head of the man? Jesus Christ. Because it's going to make you look like you're doing what Roman men do when they honor their pagan gods. So it just seems to me that makes a lot of sense when you put this in context. Okay, well then, and let me just kind of go on these verses, and I'll kind of give you my take on verses 4 through 6, and then I'll open this up for comments. Then he turns to the woman in verse 5, but every woman who has her head uncovered while praying and prophesying disgraces her head. Now, why would Roman, or why would women throughout the Greco-Roman society, why did they wear a veil on their head and cover their head? To show submission to their head, which is the man. And so becoming a Christian didn't change that, did it? I mean, now that you're a Christian woman, you're still to be in subjection to your head, the man. Now, if you're a man and you become a Christian, well, no longer should you regard these pagan deities as your head. No, now you have a new head, Jesus Christ, as Paul points out. But a woman who becomes a Christian, she still needs to reflect submission to her head, the man. And so what Paul says is that if you remove your veil, that sign of submission, or you don't put it on when you pray and prophesy, maybe because you're trying to then act like these Christian men, because you're praying and prophesying just like they are, Paul's saying, But wait a minute, you're a woman, and that does make you different than that Christian man because you as a woman have a man as your head. And you might be doing the same action, praying and prophesying, but the roles of man and woman still exist. Those roles that God set up from the very beginning, and you still need to reflect that. And so Paul says, if you as a Christian woman pray and prophesy without your head covered, it's going to dishonor your head, and your head would be the man. And he wants them to think about that. And so he and then he goes on further and he says, if your judgment is, well, I don't need to do that, I don't need to worry about maintaining my feminine role when I'm praying and prophesying like a man does, well, then Paul says, well, then why don't you go ahead and have your head shaved like a man and have your hair cut off like a man? Now, I do think there he is talking hypothetical, because would a Corinthian woman have wanted to have her head shaved like a man would have, or have their hair cut short like a man? Well, no. And I think what he's trying to say is, well, then you need to be consistent with it. I mean, he's just reasoning with them and trying to get them to see, if you somehow think that praying and prophesying, which is the same action that a man is doing, that somehow just blurs all this distinction, and so you're in the same role as a man, well, then go all the way and go ahead and have your hair like a man would. Well, they wouldn't want to do that. And so what he's really arguing is, see, even you recognize there is still a difference between men and women. And the fact that you become a Christian and that you're one in Jesus Christ doesn't change the fact that your roles are the same roles that God set up from the very beginning. And so as a woman, you need to reflect that. And you need to show your submission to your the man who is your head. And so he says in verse 6, if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, and it would have had disgraced a Corinthian woman, certainly, to have suddenly had her hair like a man's hair, her head shaved or cut like a man's head. He says, well, then let her cover her head. Be a woman all the time. Don't, you know, recognize even when you're praying and prophesying, you are a woman. Does that make some sense? That's my thought on that. That's my take on that. And that he is talking in that culture, in that society, to how a woman would show her submission to a man. And he's addressing how in that culture, in that pagan world, a Roman man would have showed his submission to the pagan gods. And so he's trying to get both the men and women to recognize, okay, now that you're Christians, what does that mean of you? What changes? What maybe doesn't change? Seems to me that's what he's doing here. Before we move on in these verses, comments or questions about that? If you want to disagree, agree, bring up another idea, whatever. Mickey?
Were these coverings worn all the time? Any time a woman was in public, to show that respect to her husband?
That question is a wonderful question, and that's debated. So I want to be very fair about this. That is debated. But I think when you really go back and look at the historical evidence, that it does become very clear that in the Greco-Roman culture in general, yes, women would customarily wear their head covered when they were in a position where it would show submission to a man out in public or wherever. Yes, that would have been the regular cultural symbol or a cultural symbol that they would have used to show that they are a woman and showing deference to the man who was over them. And so I think what Paul's talking about is in this particular case of praying and prophesying, they were thinking, well, they didn't need to do that. Whether that meant taking off what they normally would have had on, or whether as they now begin to engage in praying and prophesying, they purposely don't put that on. Whichever way you want to look at that, I think it yes, was something that they would do as a regular way of showing their submission to a man. Yes.
I have one other question.
Sure.
At what age, or was it only at marriage, that the woman started wearing a veil?
Well, there's some evidence of even the younger women showing deference to their father or as a maiden, a lot of those nitty-gritty questions, I mean, we really just aren't certain about all of that. I think you can be very certain, yes, these veils or the toga pulled up over the head to cover the head, yes, that was a cultural practice. And women did that regularly. I think that's just a fact. Now, all the nitty-gritties of, okay, when did they wear it and not wear it, under what circumstances, at what age, and that's a little more obscure, as far as I'm aware. John?
I'm just thinking, as you read through 1 Corinthians, especially the last several chapters, and the detail really
And your point from that is what? I mean, I agree with you. There's a lot of problems there in Corinth, but Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, you can certainly see that Paul is emphasizing that your behavior is going to say something about what you think, about how you feel, about your role. I mean, and I think that's the point that you're getting at, that behavior is going to be paramount. Right.
Not the answer to their question specifically, but it was obvious that they were troubled, and in many ways, the culture must have been extremely all the Lord and very moral.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. Yeah, John?
I know in this passage that Paul is spending most of his time dealing with head covering for the woman, but I think the fact that he starts this whole thing out in verse 4 by addressing the role of the man and by reiterating that later on in verse 7, I think he's making a point as far as the sequence of the breakdown of roles. And that may not be an over point that he's trying to drive home, but I think that the breakdown of the roles starts in society with the man's failure to honor his God-given role and his rejection of the Lord. And when that failure starts, there is a sequence that of the breakdown in social roles where the subject to Lord's rejection is now completely, you can look at our society and see how it will eventually be completely dissolved. There are no gender roles. And it starts right there in verse 4, and it starts today with the role of the man and his failure to honor the God-given responsibilities.
That's a great point, John. I just amen to that, and maybe just to put an exclamation point on it. I think it's very impressive that Paul emphasizes that man who is the head of the woman, he has his own head. And I don't want us to, you know, yet get into our society and our application and all this, but I appreciate your point so well. I think it is so true that we have a lot of men in our society today who frankly just don't want to be in the role of a man. They don't want that responsibility. That's one reason why, you know, these male-female roles both are kind of blurred. Because in part, it's the men just sort of abdicating their role and tying in with what John's saying. Men, we don't have a right to do that. We ourselves are subject to our head, Jesus Christ. And I don't care whether you like it or not. If you're a husband, that's your role. If you're a male, you have a certain role there, whether you're married or not. That's your responsibility, and you better fulfill that as a faithful servant of Jesus Christ. And if you will recognize your own subservience to Him, you're going to be a lot better head to your wife who has to be subservient to you. If you really recognize what it means to be in submission to Jesus Christ. I think that's what John's saying. I think that's so very, very true. Irma?
I think, too, though, that part of the problem he was addressing was could have been a certain arrogance on the part of the woman, because at that point, what she's saying when she takes her covering off is, God has honored me by name, we pray and prophesy. So I have this relationship. I am in submission directly to Him, leaving out the woman.
Irma, that is exactly what I think is the case. And I think when you get to chapter 14, where Paul, at least there, clearly is addressing the worship assembly, and he makes the point that the women need to remain silent in that worship assembly, I think that's very clearly what's going on there. We have to realize, folks, again, as we try to read these Bible passages in their historical, cultural context, you know, We are used to the idea in our society of men and women legally, constitutionally being regarded as equal. You know, at least we've had some various additions to the Constitution to make that clear. But now we all get that in our legal system. But in that society, I mean, the idea, I'm not going to say that you didn't have some women who were in some kind of a religious elevated role. I mean, you did have some priestesses and certain cults that, you know, had some authority even over men, almost like a queen would have authority over those who were underneath her station. But nevertheless, within that station, the men are always above the women of their station. And so the idea in the first century Greco-Roman world, well, I'll put it like this. Even the idea that you would have a group, a mixed group like this, all you women sitting here with men to be disciples of this teacher Jesus, that was absolutely just novel. I mean, that was iconoclastic. I mean, this is what Christianity was doing. Christianity was saying that women were just as important to God and their souls were just as important to God as men. And women needed to be disciples of Jesus Christ and learn the teaching of Jesus just like men. That was not the way it was normally done. That was not the way it was thought of in Jewish culture. I mean, men were educated, not the women. The women cooked dinner and made babies. I mean, that's the way it was. And so the idea that you would have women who would be, you know, engaging in these things with men, learning, praying and prophesying along with the men. I mean, that was something that was just novel. But and so if you understand that, can't you see how a problem like this would have arisen? Where women, as Irma says, it kind of becomes a, I don't mean this as a pun, a heady experience, you know? And so they ignore the fact that they really have someone who's still a head over them. That they're still a woman and they're always going to be a woman in this earthly life. And so they still need to reflect that role. And so I think what Irma is saying is probably exactly what is going on. And so they were thinking, well, I'm praying and prophesying just like a man is. You know, why do I have a direct submission to Jesus Christ, and they're ignoring the fact that there's still a woman and the man is the, I want to say middleman, but I make another pun, and I don't mean to make a pun, but I think that's the idea. Well, I mean, oftentimes that would happen, and yet here's where Christianity then was rubbing up against that society, where here's a woman who becomes a Christian against her husband's objection.
Right, and that's what that's.
And so,
what
I'm yeah.
But what I'm saying the other way around doesn't seem that was a problem, that the man would be very
good. Well, but again, the very nature of the gospel meant that each person individually had to make their own decision. I mean, I think you're right, there'd be a great deal of influence that a man would have over his whole household, but nevertheless,
you think the versions too, it says his whole household.
Sure,
too.
Sure.
A
lot of influence there that would have, you know, but of course, again, the gospel was saying each individual, though, has to have his own faith for God to honor that. Okay. Yes. Okay, well, you're raising, you know, that question that we brought up Wednesday night that I think you have to ask, and it's hard to give an answer. I mean, I'll be the first one to acknowledge this. Is what he's talking about here in chapter 11, is this the worship assembly? A lot of times people assume it is, without even questioning it. But the problem with that is, well, let me just say this. The problem, at least you have to address, is that in chapter 14, he tells the women clearly there in the worship assembly to remain silent. So, you know, that's the reason why I think you can make a real good case. I'm not sure if it's correct or not, but I think you can make a real good case that what he's really talking about here, because he always specifies praying and prophesying, that this was perhaps something that was done out in public, maybe in the markets as they were trying to teach people the gospel of Jesus. So here's praying and prophesying going on, not in a Christian worship assembly, but out there where especially that Corinthian society would have observed them. And so maybe that's, you know, why he's addressing it here. But then he makes the point in chapter 14, when they're in the Christian worship assembly, well, that's where the women should keep silent. But, you know, that to me, what I just described there, that scenario, that makes sense to me. Am I certain that's what's going on here? No, but it makes sense. I just think you do have a problem if you say, well, here in chapter 11, that's the worship assembly, like it's normally assumed. Well, it's just very odd that he'd be talking about them praying and prophesying in the worship assembly and only address where their head is covered when they shouldn't be talking at all, according to what he then would later say in chapter 14. So that to me doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean that's kind of part of the issue there. Chapter 14 is part of three chapters that are speaking about spiritual gifts, and he clearly is talking about, you know, prophesying and tongue speaking and the exercising of spiritual gifts. But then he's seen, I mean, you could at least argue this, that he makes a very general statement like what you see over in 1 Timothy 2 for the women to keep silent. I mean, in that passage, 1 Timothy 2, it's very clear that's just a general statement. It's not spiritual gift context, but just a general statement. Women should keep silence. So that to me suggests that in chapter 14, verse 32 and following, he talks about the women keeping silent, that he, whether it's to speak up with spiritual gifts or not, keep silent. Just a general statement, it would seem to me. Somebody else raised their hand, I thought. Yeah, Kyle. Well, he doesn't use that precise terminology, but I don't disagree with what you're really getting at, because and this is my take on it, and disagree if you think otherwise. But it seems to me that Paul's whole tenor in this paragraph is not the tone or the tenor of someone who is issuing commands about what God has decreed as if it were some universal kind of binding teaching, but rather it to me is the tone and the tenor of someone who is saying, listen, here are the principles, but you've got to judge how to apply those principles in your society. And in your society, Paul is saying, this is the impression it's going to give, isn't it? And do you really, as men and women, want to give that impression? In fact, he even says in verse 13, judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? And he goes on to talk about that and uses the illustration of the hair length. And then in verse 16, he concludes the discussion by saying, but if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor have the churches of God. It seems to me that what he's arguing there is a judgment. And he's saying, listen, these other churches of God, we don't do what you're talking about. We don't come to the judgment you're coming to, that it's okay to go ahead and ignore the role of a woman when you pray and prophesy. So, you know, why are you coming to that judgment? It just seems to me that everything he says has the tone of not that he's issuing an edict, but that he is trying to plead with them and argue with them to see your judgment that you're making here is causing you to give an impression that absolutely goes against the role of men and women, God, Christ, man, woman, that you know is part of the tradition that you say you want to follow. So it just seems to me that that's the whole tone. He's trying to get them to apply these Christian universal principles in their society with their societal symbols. And in their society, the symbol of the head covering signified something for a man or a woman. Seems to me that that's what's going on. We're almost out of time. Other comments? Questions? All right, what we want to do Wednesday night is we can, if you have some other questions on these particular verses, we can certainly do that. But we want to talk about a related question that was raised that relates to this idea. How do we go to the Bible and determine when something a New Testament apostle or a New Testament writer is saying, when that is universally binding, or when he is talking about something that is cultural? And then also we want to talk about, okay, however we understand this passage in 1 Corinthians 11, okay, how does this apply to us today in our culture and our society? And that's where I would like to get into some of the questions maybe of practical application for us. I think there are some very important applications. Even if you decide that the covering itself was a cultural symbol for the Greco-Roman society, there still are issues of application for us. So how do we determine all that, and then what judgments do we need to make about all that? That's what we want to talk about Wednesday night. Okay?
Are you going to discuss the angels?
Yes, yeah. I had meant to get to that today, but we didn't quite have time. But I'll give you my ignorance on that statement. if I may have your attention, will all of the deacons, both the older deacons and the new deacons, will you meet in the back room back here with the elders just for a moment before services? All the deacons, if you will.